Time now for our presentation, and one of our members, Hillary Craig, is going to be our presenter today. Hillary was raised as a Catholic in a family that also included a number of Protestants and agnostics. She attended a convent school in Harare, Zimbabwe, then called Salisbury, Southern Rhodesia, where her classmates included all kinds of Christians, Jews, members of the Greek Orthodox Church, and in the early 60s, Muslims and Hindus. The local parish priests were Jesuits, who acquainted Hillary with liberation theology and many spiritual practices. Hillary left the Catholic fold in 1967 when she decided she no longer saw eye to eye with the Pope. She went unchurched for many years until she joined the Regina Fellowship here in 1992. A few years ago, she also connected with the Regina Insight Meditation Community. Hillary.
Thank you, Jim. I didn't realize I'd get such a huge, long biography. I'd like to just make one comment, and that is that what I'm talking about today has to do with the Horn of Africa and women in the Horn of Africa, and you'll see what that means. So, it was not long after I started planning a winter visit to Southern Africa that I decided that on the way to Zimbabwe and South Africa, I would stop in Kampala to visit my friend Hala El-Karib, who was working there. So I emailed Hala and asked whether this would be okay with her. And the rest, as they say, was history. Now, David, they've got a picture of Hala there. Beautiful. Perfect. Now, I hope I can operate this thing. One day was when I was in Kampala, I stopped by Hala's office. As we were chatting, she reached over and picked up two publications that she had been involved in the producing of and insisted that I take them. One of them was this. It's called Women in Islam, Siha Journal, Issue Number 1. After my return, I read this other publication, which was a small booklet, which was stories of women who were refugees. But I just nibbled on the content of the larger publication. And I should just say here that SIHA stands for Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. Now, the reason I nibbled on it is it's 100 pages long. And there are all sorts of articles, some of them scholarly articles, so it wasn't something that was easy to just sort of read. Anyway, so this is a picture of the Horn of Africa. You can see there are different definitions of the Horn of Africa. That's basically the area. It also, in my in this journal, includes Yemen, which is actually in next to Saudi Arabia there. So here is the map, it'll give you an idea. Recently, I decided the time had come to plunge in and read the magazine. And what better justification for doing so than using what I read as the basis for a presentation to the fellowship? In the course of reading the first SIHA journal from cover to cover, I learned a huge amount. However, in the time that I have today, I shall only be able to share a few tidbits with you. Given the topic that I pre-selected, I've decided that I'll give you a sense of the big picture, and then I'll share with you some of the good news stories that are included. To begin with, I'm going to share some excerpts from Hala's introduction to this groundbreaking publication, the first of the series. The second issue has just been made available. It gives you a sense of the time, place, and circumstances that led to the production of this exceptional publication. And these are Hala's words. The story began some time ago in early 2011, inspired through a meeting of SIHA Network members in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. in the aftermath of serious meetings, participants from the various horn countries came together for dinner. And as an Ethiopian band played Somali and Sudanese music, we danced and sang into the evening. It was a beautiful scene to see women from Somalia and Sudan relaxed and free. Though as the evening drew to a close, the reality dawned that many of the women would not be able to enjoy the same sense of joy and freedom when they left for their own countries the following morning. The same women are often seen covered with heavy clothes, wrapped in long headscarves, stifled by the repressive conditions of their day-to-day lives. Women in the Muslim Horn can neither dance nor be themselves in public. I cannot be myself in Sudan or Somalia, where I am like a ghost, a shadow of my existence. The overall political and social environment in the Muslim Horn has turned extremely hostile against women's presence in public realms. However, the risk lies in the fact that this hostility is comfortably placed on the leading religious beliefs, hence cannot be challenged, or rather, this is what is often assumed to be the case. However, Muslim women have become the human face of war, discrimination, and disintegration of society. Yet at the same time, theirs have been stories of resilience and hope in the face of rapid changes in the region. In the course of my presentation, I shall share some excerpts from some of the stories that Hala has gathered. I will also provide some background quotes from many of the scholars whose works are included in the publication. First, I want to say that there are many well-documented assertions throughout the publication that indicate that there's absolutely no basis in the Quran for discriminating against women or keeping them out of the public realm. I want to point out, however, that I am intrigued by the fact that every single one of the women quoted in the publication describes herself as Muslim. Most of the women indicate that they have chosen to wear the hijab and are not only comfortable with the choice, but happy with it. Here I'm going to interject a personal comment where the importance of religious faith and community that it brings. Growing up in white Rhodesia in my teens, I was very much opposed to the existing regime. Much of my political awareness came to me through progressive Catholic contacts, especially the Jesuits. My connection to them and my place in the Catholic faith was also very important to me. It provided me with a community of like-minded people who shared a common faith. I'm going to finish this introduction with a quote from an article by a male scholar, Abu Sa'id. I am sure that I am Muslim. My worst fear is that people in Europe may consider and treat me as a critic of Islam. I am not. I'm a researcher. I'm critical of old and modern Islamic thought. Now, I'm interpreting the statement as meaning that he critiques old and modern Islamic thought. I say this because I think there was maybe a translation issue in the use of critical, when it says I'm critical of old and modern Islamic thought. I think it means he critiques it. This is a picture by a photographer, Bushra Mutawakil. In the picture you can see pictures of in each picture, it's called mother, daughter, doll, and in each picture there is. Although in this picture you can see that she's wearing a hijab, and the little girl's wearing nothing, the doll's wearing nothing. In the next one, the little girl is wearing a veil. In each one, they get progressively more covered until in the end you can see nothing. So I'm starting with the visual work of Bushra Mutawakil, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I hope so. This picture graphically shows the extent of what is meant by being veiled. These pictures are part of a series entitled Mother-Daughter Doll. The series was first exhibited in the National Museum in Sana'a, Yemen, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right either. It is part of an exhibit entitled Words of Eyes. The exhibit has been shown in a number of places across the world and has been acquired by the British Museum in London. The exhibit was, in the photographer's words, inspired by seeing so many women covered in layers of black and, shockingly, seeing little girls no older than 7 or 8 wearing the black abaya, that's the long gown, and niqab, like mini versions of their mothers. Mutawakkil comments that women used to wear more colorful clothing. When asked why this has changed, she says, "According to my understanding, this has nothing to do with Islam, although it's being done in the name of Islam and modesty. I feel it is triggered by distorted interpretations of Islam and a strong fear of women and a desire to eradicate them from public life or the arena of public life." Mutawakkil goes on to say that she sees herself as a visual social anthropologist. To quote her, "If my work of documenting and processing the world in pictures conjures strong feelings and provokes engagements, discussions, and debate, I feel I have succeeded somehow. It is through this dialogue, as a very first step, that change may slowly materialize." And I would encourage you to go on the internet and find her TED Talk. If you need to know her name so you can find it, just ask me afterwards. When asked about the feedback she has received, Mutawakkil says that most has been very positive, especially from women. Now, Zahra Ahmed, founder of the Somali Women's Development Center, that's her picture there. Zahra used to work at the Mogadishu airport. Lack of safety led her to leave the job. Subsequently, she founded several civil society organizations to promote human rights and women's accessibility and participation in society. Zahra's father, a policeman, made sure that all of his kids were educated, and he put the girls into even better schools than the boys. I love examples like this of decent, progressive men. Zahra then went to university, where she graduated with a degree in international and Sharia law. This provided a solid background to her work advocating for women's rights. Zahra believes that her Islamic faith has encouraged her to persevere and continue her work. According to her, Islam encourages helping the poor, protecting the vulnerable, preventing sexual violence, avoiding harmful traditional practices, and building peace and security. She encourages other women to embrace their faith and practice what it says. Zahra is encouraged by the fact that many Somali women from the diaspora are returning to build their country. In spite of the dangerous environment, Zahra continues to do her work. Story number 3, and I don't know how to pronounce this. The name is Rehmach, I think, Kasule, Ugandan entrepreneur. At the age of 12, Rehmach left her rural village to live with her city-dwelling brother and attend a girls' school where she had to learn to speak English. She thrived and excelled, but was particularly inspired by reading Women of Substance by Barbara Taylor Bradford, which I was not familiar with, but there you are. Rehma and her 4 friends started Century Marketing, a very successful company. In addition, she started CEDA International for the development of leadership and entrepreneur skills for girls and young women. Also in 2012, she started a program specifically for Muslim boys and youth whom she felt were not receiving the support they needed. With respect to her religious affiliation, the day came when she decided that she wanted to wear the hijab. It gave her affirmation about her religion, while being respected more for a woman as a woman for wearing the hijab. It has reinforced who she is as a person. A strong self and a practical sense is what shines through her work and words. And these are her words. In the end, out there, people don't judge you for what you wear, but rather for what you say or your character. Life is what you make it. And I realized I got one picture. I missed a picture somehow. Don't know how I did that. Anyway, that should have, this is the one I should be at now. It's about Fatima Mernissi, the forgotten queens of Islam. Fatima Mernissi is a researcher and writer from Morocco who holds a doctorate in sociology and lectures at the University of Rabat in Morocco. One of the best-known Arab Muslim feminists, her courageous and pioneering writing represents an attempt to undermine the ideological systems that silence and oppress Muslim women. Her book, The Forgotten Queens of Islam, explores the impact of women in Islamic history. She suggests that, in her words, it is impossible to exclude women from politics. They have, throughout Muslim history, led, participated in, or influenced different aspects of the political process. Here is one interesting quote from her work. By monopolizing the mosque, the ruling male elites also monopolized the legislation. And then we get to this one, which is quite an interesting picture. And this is the story of Nujood, and I don't know how you pronounce that, Ali, the heroine of Brides. It's hard to believe that a 10-year-old girl is the most famous divorced woman in Yemen, but that is Nujood's reality. Her impoverished parents chose a husband for her when she was 9. The man was a postman aged 30. Perhaps the backstory is that her parents wanted to have one less mouth to feed and also to preserve the family's honor, since they knew that Nujood was being eyed by a man who had raped her sister. Although legislation indicates that a man may not engage in sexual activity with a child bride until she reaches puberty, Nujood had to run from room to room to avoid being raped by her husband. One of her father's wives advised her to go to court, and that is what she did. She left the house alone, took a bus and a taxi, and waited in the courthouse until she was noticed. She was noticed by a female lawyer who agreed to take her case on pro bono. The case was won because Nujood's husband had contravened the law by having intercourse with her prior to sexual maturity. Nujood's story went around the world and has inspired others to take the same path. She describes her present life as sweet as candy. She wants to become a lawyer. Surprise. And I've missed a page here. Where am I? Oh, sorry. Here it is. The next picture. These are just pictures that were in the magazine of different aspects of veiling. We'll come to that in a minute. So story number 6, Amira Osman Hamid, dressed to be flogged. Amira's story is the final one in SIHA 2014 journal. It comes in the form of an open letter written by her. This Sudanese activist has degrees in computer engineering and international relations. Since 2002, she has had to stand trial twice, once for wearing trousers and once for not wearing a scarf. In Amira's words, "The charges are not for wearing a scarf, but it seems that my actual offense is being a woman." In her letter, Amira relates her experiences being arrested, but she also comments in depth and at length on her interpretation of what happened to her and many other women. As a woman who has chosen not to wear the hijab, she says, "The hijab has been magnified beyond what it actually is. It is as if a woman would encase all the values, all respect and pride, the religion itself and the honor of Islam, your tribe, your family, in a piece of cloth. Dress in general, and the hijab specifically, has become a means of control and suppression and an instrument to frighten women, capable of making them feel bad about the female body, as if it was shameful, something to be punished for. It manipulates the attention of women to be constantly occupied with their body, which becomes a limiting factor instead of their doing something useful. It affects women's self-esteem." And I'm going to conclude with some excerpts from Harla's story, but not before I show you that last picture, which I think is hilarious. It's for Miss Niqab. And of course, you can't see anybody. This is Harla's story, and her story is Muslim like my grandmother. "I grew up in a big house right by the edge of the Blue Nile in Wad Madani city. At that time, Wad Madani was almost the largest urban center in Sudan. Surrounded by the villages of the Jazeera agricultural scheme, which brought people from across Sudan to settle and seek new livelihoods. One central figure kept everything together in my world and the world of many others, my grandmother, around whom everything revolved. Harla describes her grandmother's house, including the classic bookshelf with the old leather-covered Quran and the tafsir interpretive text of Islamic religion, in addition to such other classics such as the Kitab al-Aghani, the Book of Songs. Harla goes on to say, "At that time, the Muslim women of my country didn't have to hide or bend their heads. They put on light cotton tobes," and I think those are sort of just a light gown, I'm not sure exactly, "only, and did not cover their heads with an extra piece of cloth or hide their features and identity as women. Women like my grandmother walked with their heads held high, fully visible. My grandmother is my role model both as a human being and as a Muslim. Women like her have managed to struggle peacefully through a male-dominated society, to seize their place and to unfurl their lives as they should be. May God bless her soul. She lived a fulfilling life and passed away quietly." And I'm just going to leave it there. So I hope that has been enlightening in some way.
Like, do we entertain some questions?
Comments? Yeah.
Comments, okay.
Yeah. Jim, are you doing the run around?
I think we got it there. Okay.
Do you think in all that they're making progress? Because Muslims in different areas seem to have stronger faiths, or women have more freedom. In Afghanistan, before the Taliban came in, the women could wear jeans, they could get educated, they could go without anything on their head. And then when the Taliban came in, everything changed. Doesn't Oprah have a school in Johannesburg where she is going to educate women that, you know, can progress and help other women? Do you think that women are really making any progress in getting their equality?
I think it depends on where you are and what you're speaking of. But I think that, you know, I made the comment about my own experience with, you know, in the Christian environment, in the Catholic environment, in an environment where there was a lot of oppression going on. And I think that, you know, when you do get negative forces, you know, people to fight back. And I certainly see that happening. And I don't know a lot about what is, say, happening in Afghanistan or the Philippines or whatever. I don't even know a lot of what is happening here. I'm just basing what I'm saying on what I've heard or what I've read. And I thought that this is just such an interesting sort of patchwork of things. And I mean, there's still a huge amount of oppression in those countries, for sure.
Thank you very much, Hillary. That was great. One of the things that is topmost in my mind when I'm thinking about the Muslim world is Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabi religion, which in effect supports the kind of things that ISIL represents. And Saudi Arabia continues to, you know, do the kind of things that are counterproductive in the world, and yet it seems to be a great ally of the West, which is very upsetting to me.
Well, one wonders about the West, taking on an ally that does things like that. I was thinking, there was somewhere I read that there was something like 2,000 beheadings in Saudi Arabia in the last year. I mean, that's pretty horrifying. But why is the West, well, you know, we know why the West is on their side. It all has to do with oil.
It's echoing. I read a novel about 3 or 4 years ago about a teacher, and it was in the northern part of Africa, and she had several women students, and some of those young women, although they became very educated, wanted to continue wearing the long gown, and they actually switched back and forth, and several of them went back to wearing the long gown because they felt that it was it made them freer in a way, because then people only related to them as this person, this face that they could see, and not to how beautiful their legs were or what kind of a bosom they had. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
That issue did come up in several of the articles, and there was one situation where I think it was the photographer was talking about how she sort of was somewhere and a man said he was feeling too distracted because he could see her neck. Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, in a sense, that's his problem. But it's clear that, you know, when there's this focus, when the focus is so strong in the society, it's inevitable that a sort of reverse thing happens and people become obsessed with what they can't see. So that seems to come out in what I've read, you know, that it's problematical. And the people sort of say, look, I'd rather be dressed that way because then I don't have to worry about things. And I can understand where they're coming from.
Thank you. The comment about whether women are making progress in countries like Afghanistan or other places, I mean, first of all, I don't think it has anything to do with religion. It all has to do with power. Who wants to have the power, and what means do they use to keep that power? And I remember a long, long time, I shouldn't say that, almost 50 years ago, Bernadette Devlin was an MP in British Parliament. She was from County Armagh in Ireland. And she was quite a young woman. I think she was 19 at the time. Anyway, she said the same thing. Clearly, the conflict in Ireland was all about power. It had nothing to do with religion or love or any of that. It was strictly about power and who could keep the power. So I wish we could somehow separate the word religion from all of this impression, but of course we can't.
Yes, is this working here? I was just thinking back to my childhood, which is more than 50 years ago, and thinking about the sort of some of the oppression that my mother experienced as a woman in the workplace. You know, where for most of her work life, she only received 4/5 of the salary for exactly the same job. as a man. And I mean, and there were certainly issues about clothing there. I have an absolutely hilarious photograph of my mother as I think she was probably in her late teens, and she's wearing pants in those days. She's wearing pants, she's sitting sideways on a big leather chair, and she's smoking a pipe. As I say, it's hilarious. It was my mother all the way through. And I think about the fact that, you know, when I first started university, my first 2 years, we weren't allowed to wear pants. So, I mean, that was quite a long time ago. But, you know, we've certainly seen a change in the context of our culture about what we can and we can't wear. And sometimes I think that I would like to see a little bit more, about what people are wearing, because I look at some of the things that people wear and I sort of think, ah!
Thank you for your excellent presentation. I was wondering, do you know who funds the magazine? The name, it was Women in...
It's the Saskatchewan... That's a good question, and I don't know, but my friend Harla is just an incredible person. I think she had an editorial, there's an editorial board and so on. And that's a very good question, because it doesn't say who funds it.
Do you know if it would be possible to obtain copies or how one subscribes?
I was going to email her after doing this and say, okay, Harla, I did this presentation using your magazine as a basis, and I want a copy of the second one. How do I get it?
Exactly.
So I could
Thank
certainly
you.
Let
You'll
you know
that.
what the results are.
Thanks very much.
This is the experience I had a few years ago, well, more or less when I came over here. It was outside the Cornwall Centre, and there was a young woman that came out that was all covered up, and all I saw was a pair of brown eyes, and the man she was with had a European dress on, and she looked frightened. All I could see was the brown eyes, but she looked nervous. And a young woman followed her in. She came out. This young woman followed in, leaving nothing to the imagination. So the contrast between the two of them, it struck me as I couldn't get over the difference between the two women.
I get your point, Thelma.
They're kind of more or less the same age, I would think.
Yeah.
Okay, we got time for one last.
Thank you, Hillary. That was very interesting, and especially the photographs showing the extent and changes of healing. These days, I think a lot about the conflict in Syria and the whole area in there, and including Afghanistan. And I think about the influence that we are trying to have for human rights and the backlash that's sort of saying, leave us alone, this is our culture, get out. And the division between the sense of we ought not be interfering in other countries' political sphere, meaning not just their government but the culture, that we should not be interfering, and yet feeling the need to ally with the downtrodden and oppressed. I just wondered if you have thoughts about that.
I think I have one sentence answer to that, and that is, it's very complex. If I had an answer, I would, you know, I think that on one hand, when we think about the whole issue of Saudi Arabia and the fact of the alliance with that country, which is extremely repressive. So, I mean, in terms of our countries being involved, often they have other issues that they're interested in, and it has nothing to do with human rights whatsoever. In terms of human rights, I think that what, at the local level, what we need to do is to sort of be mindful that people may choose to dress or to behave as they do, as long as it doesn't hurt or harm other people or themselves, I think. And that gets into a lot of complicated issues. But I think as long as it doesn't hurt other people, I really feel that people should be allowed to wear niqabs, hijabs, whatever. I mean, I see people wearing niqabs, particularly at the university, but also in other parts, and I'm surprised at how many people I see wearing hijabs, and, you know, if that's their choice, that's their choice. I don't have anything more to say about that. Anyway, thank you very much.